Lecture 2, Argument by Desire, Surprised by Joy, and The Pilgrim's Regress.
In this second lecture, we shall consider again the biography of C.S. Lewis, but from a radically different perspective, that of his inner spiritual journey. We shall see how Lewis, in both his non-fictional and fictional autobiographies, defined his movement towards Christianity in terms of joy and desire, and how the centrality of that desire in his conversion functioned as one of Lewis's main apologetics. In his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis explains that throughout his childhood, he experienced brief but profound moments of longing. And Lewis had a word for those moments of longing, and that word was simply joy. Now, when Lewis used the word joy, he did not just mean happiness. By joy, he meant an intense, overwhelming desire for an indefinable, numinous something that was just beyond his grasp. Joy, that is, was a feeling, but a feeling that pointed beyond itself. It was an intimation of some higher, generally spiritual reality. Again, not an end in itself, but a means to some higher end. Now, Lewis argued, if one tried to hold on to the feeling of joy and enjoy it as an end in itself, it would quickly vanish. And Lewis liked to use the metaphor of Orpheus and Eurydice. Some of you know the myth that Hades allowed Orpheus to take his wife Eurydice out of the underworld. But he was told that as he ascended the stairs to the world again, he could not look back at her. Well, he's doing fine till he gets to the very end. He gets nervous. He turns back for a glance and watches Eurydice pulled back into the underworld. Again, if we stop and look at the feeling and treasure it as an end in itself, we lose the joy. Likewise, if we try greedily to reproduce the feeling, it would never come. In fact, it is only when the mind forgets itself and seeks something else that the joy comes. Joy is not a manufacturing of a religious experience. If you try to make the emotion or hold on to the emotion, it doesn't come, or worse, you lose it. You've got to not be seeking it, and then it comes. We'll understand more as we go through the lecture today. Now, Lewis had another word for joy, and it's the German word Sehnsucht, which means longing. But more often, he uses the word joy. Now, before considering the theological and philosophical import of joy, let us first examine some specific examples of joy in the life of C.S. Lewis. And I will be quoting from Surprised by Joy, his autobiography. Lewis's first encounter with joy occurred when his brother Warren, or Warney, showed him a toy garden made of moss and twigs arranged on the lid of a biscuit tin. Well, Lewis tells us, his glimpse of that garden and his later recollection of that glimpse transported the young Lewis to an Eden of moist and fertile greenness. And we're talking about a cheesy little thing on a tin. We're not talking about anything beautiful. But for some reason, it caught Lewis and gave him an intimation of some greater spiritual reality. In fact, Lewis wrote, "As long as I live, my imagination of paradise will retain something of my brother's toy garden." Lewis is not being facetious or cute here. He meant that. Always, his view of heaven had that glimpse that he first felt when he saw the toy garden. The next encounter of joy in his early childhood now came when he read Beatrix Potter's Squirrel Nutkin, an experience, Lewis said, that troubled him with the idea of autumn. We'd say you get goosebumps, you feel something beyond yourself. That's what Lewis is getting at. One more. A third encounter, also literary, came when the young Lewis's eyes caught suddenly these words on a book. "I heard a voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead, is dead." Now, at this point, Lewis didn't know much about Norse mythology, didn't even know who Balder was. But he says when he read those words, a flash of desire hit him, and he suddenly felt a sense of cold, remote northern regions. He would later call this northernness. Now, partly because of that, Lewis became a great lover of Norse mythology, and he loved Wagner, especially the Ring Cycle. And he always linked it to that first feeling, that intimation of this cold northern region. In fact, One of Lewis's lifelong friendships began, a young man named Arthur Greaves was an invalid. Lewis went to visit him, and when he walked in the room, he saw opened on his bed, or on the desk, a book of Norse mythology. And Lewis looked at Greaves, and Greaves looked at Lewis with that look that says, "You like this too?" And that one moment, that shared sense of northernness, made them fast friends, and they wrote letters to each other their whole life, which have been collected in a 500-page book of their letters. Now, I'm really a romantic scholar, and joy sounds a lot like something that William Wordsworth talks about in his autobiography, The Prelude. It's what he calls, Wordsworth, spots of time. Now, what does Wordsworth mean by that? Well, spots of time are childhood encounters with the power of nature that, when recollected in later years, yield visionary power and insight. Wordsworth tells about a whole bunch of situations where the young Wordsworth had a mystical experience with nature that just sort of overawed him. And the older Wordsworth would recollect those spots of time, and he would use them to sort of rejuvenate and refresh himself. Now, there is a similarity between joy and spots of times in terms of that flash of desire, but there's a big difference, and let me explain. Whereas Wordsworth's spots of time point backwards nostalgically to something lost, Lewis's joy is a signpost that points forward to a richer world. Again, whereas Wordsworth's spots of times need to be hoarded up lest he lose the vision. In fact, the older Wordsworth was afraid he would forget the spots and lose his poetic powers. That's not the case with Lewis. Joy, on the other hand, must be let go of if the true vision is to come. So again, spots of joy point backwards. Lewis's joy points forward to a greater reality. Don't worry about the joy itself. Let the joy point you as a signpost forward. And this leads us to what is perhaps Lewis's most original contribution to the study of apologetics, which you will remember, apologetics means a logical defense of the Christian faith. Well, Lewis had an argument that often is called the argument by desire or the argument by joy. Here is how the argument by desire works. Just as the fact that we experience thirst is proof that we are creatures for whom the drinking of water is natural, just so, the fact that we desire an object that our natural world cannot supply suggests the existence of another supernatural one. Everything has to have an origin for Lewis. If we desire something our natural, earthly, material world cannot fulfill, that suggests that there is another supernatural one. Just as the fact that we're thirsty suggests that we are creatures who need water. Now, Lewis is quick to add, the desire does not guarantee that we will achieve that other world. After all, if I'm stranded in the desert, no matter how thirsty I am, I'm going to die for lack of water. But, Lewis says, it does suggest, the intimation of joy now, that we are creatures who are capable of achieving it and who were in some sense made to achieve it. We were made for a higher supernatural world. In a late book called Reflections on the Psalms, Lewis gives what I think is the greatest defense of the immortality of the soul. He says, why is it that human beings are continually surprised by the passage of time? We see somebody we haven't seen for 5 years and we say, my, how he's grown. Now, time is the very essence of our life. We live in time. We know nothing else but time. And yet we are continually surprised by the passage of time. That, Lewis says, would be as strange as if a fish were constantly surprised by the wetness of water. And Lewis says, that would be strange indeed, unless, of course, that fish were destined someday to be a land animal. Do you understand? We are destined for eternity. That is our true home, and therefore time seems always a little bit strange to us. Now, of course, the modernists, especially the Freudians, will tell us that our spiritual longings are merely products of displaced sexual desire, that love is only a sublimation of lust, that heaven is but an illusion, a superstitious wish fulfillment. But Lewis attacks that modernist assumption. Lewis says, wait a minute, the only reason moderns arrive at that conclusion he argues, is because they accept a priori. I'm going to use that word a lot. A priori means an unproven assumption that you begin an argument with. You can't prove it logically. You begin there. And he claims that this is an a priori assumption that moderns make, that the supernatural does not exist, and that matter is all there is. In other words, let me explain. If you begin with the belief there's no supernatural and all there is the physical, then you've got to come up with a natural explanation for joy. If there is no supernatural, where did our supernatural yearnings and longings come from? What Lewis is trying to say is that the Freudian doesn't arrive at that through logic, what we call inductive logic, but because they begin with the assumption that the supernatural does not exist. You see, moderns, Lewis argues, approach reality from the bottom up. They insist that the higher must always copy the lower. They refuse to consider that the lower might be the copy. Maybe love is not a sublimation of lust. Maybe lust is a mere shadow or copy of a greater divine love. Who's to say which way reality works? We now believe, moderns believe, it starts down there and moves up. Lewis says maybe the original's up there, and what we see down here is the copy. And this is a characteristic move for Lewis because he's turned everything. He's flip-flopped everything. Lewis argues that human desire is not a projection from below, but an incarnation from above. It is not an evolution, but a transposition from a heavenly eternal key. I'm sorry, from a heavenly eternal key to an earthly temporal one. Again, it starts up there and the music proceeds down. Now, modern apologists, of which I try to be one, have all been influenced by C.S. Lewis, and they would put this argument in a different way. They would say that all of us have a God-shaped vacuum. Ecclesiastes says God has written eternity on our hearts. We all have this hole in our soul, and we can't fill it. We try to fill it with drink or with sex or with good things like marriage or good works or religion or our job or career. We try everything to fill that hole, but nothing will fill it except Christ. And so it's kind of what Lewis is saying. It's kind of like we've got a circle hole and we keep trying to shove a square peg in it. It's not till we find the circle peg, which is Christ, that it fits. And so that's a sort of modern working, or not that modern, but a later working of the argument by desire. Let us move on now to Lewis's two works where he talks about joy. I'm going to begin with Lewis's fictional account of his conversion. That was the book I mentioned called The Pilgrim's Regress. And in this, again, fictional account of his conversion, Lewis develops his argument by desire by allegorizing the many false lures that disguise themselves as the true objects of desire and drive us off course. Let me go on and explain how it works. Now, you might guess that The Pilgrim's Regress is patterned after John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And indeed, there is a protagonist who's going on a journey of faith. In Pilgrim's Progress, his name is Christian. In Pilgrim's Regress, his name is John. But it's an allegory of a spiritual journey. But there's a main difference. Whereas Christian's journey in Pilgrim's Progress begins with a clear vision of the gospel of Christ. Remember, he sticks his fingers in his ears and yells, "Salvation, salvation," and goes running away from everything. Whereas his journey begins clearly, John's journey in the Pilgrim's Regress begins with a nameless desire, a flash of joy. Reared in the repressive, hypocritical town of Puritania, and everything's allegorical names like that, as you might expect, reared in that town, John's only intimation of spiritual truth comes through a mystical glimpse of a distant island. The sight of that island fills John with a sweetness and a pang, and he abandons home and family to seek after the object of his desire. The joy propels him forward to seek the final end. At first it goes well, but quickly, as in Dante's Divine Comedy, he goes astray. He loses his way, John, and is sidetracked by a number of counterfeit objects that promise falsely to fulfill his desire. He's seeking the true end of joy, but he keeps sidetracking to counterfeits. Now, the first counterfeit object is what he calls the brown girls. There's no racial implication there. The brown girls represent lust. Well, as soon as John meets a brown girl, he has sex with her. And for a while, he believes that carnal passion is the true end he seeks. Until finally he realizes, no, this carnality is merely a shadow of the greater love I'm seeking. You see, not Freud here. Freud would say it starts with the lust and builds up to love. No, here in Lewis, you begin with joy, with true love, what's called agape in Greek or caritas in Latin. You begin there, and lust is a sidetrack. It's a mere shadow. It's something that mimics desire. It reminds me of John chapter 4 when Jesus meets the woman at the well. Remember that woman? She's been married 5 times and is now living with a man who's not her husband. Obviously, this woman is seeking something, probably some kind of acceptance and love, but she's seeking it in the wrong way. The whole point of John chapter 4 is Jesus saying to her, you've been seeking it the wrong way. Let me give you the living water now. Let me show you what you're really seeking after. Again, this is to me a very moving aspect of C.S. Lewis's work. Well, as I mentioned, John soon realizes his error and leaves the brown girls behind. But guess what? He falls off onto another tangent. He finds another imitation, lesser imitation, of the joy he seeks. And this time he finds it in a sort of soft romanticism that promises fulfillment through aesthetic beauty. But you know what he soon finds? He soon discovers that the arts, far from refining desire, often act as pimps that lure us right back into the laps of the brown girls. In other words, he tries a sort of Oscar Wilde, soft decadence, art for art's sake kind of artsiness and thinks maybe that's the end. But again, even though art in itself is not bad, John realizes that if you seek the arts as an end in themselves, they become a pimp and you end up in a sort of carnality, as Oscar Wilde and many of his fellows did. Worse yet, John finds that though the first time he listens to a beautiful piece of music, it inspires in him a pang of joy. He hears some great Wagnerian opera and the pang, the joy returns. But guess what? With each successive hearing, the joy recedes as a formal, critical interest in the music as music takes its place. In other words, once the music becomes an end in itself, once again, the joy is lost. Now, in a work we'll look at in Lecture 5 called The Great Divorce, Lewis gives us the biography of a landscape painter who is first attracted to art not because he wants to paint the landscape, but because he wants to capture that light that lies behind the landscape. Any of you that are in the arts at all will know that you're often drawn to one of the humanities or one of the arts because you want to capture something that's behind the art or that is shimmering through the art. And at first, that's what you paint. But guess what happens? As time goes on, you lose your first love, to quote Revelations. You lose your love of the light and you start becoming interested in painting as an end in itself. You get interested in formal aspects. You get interested in the debates over modern art or classical art. You get involved in the kind of paintbrushes you use. And what happens is you lose the joy. You see, the painter, like John, allows his initial desire, one that should have drawn him upward to heaven, to be twisted downward or earthward to yet another counterfeit. Well, in The Great Divorce, the painter ends up losing his salvation, not because his desires are too strong, but because they are too weak for the overwhelming joy, the consummate reality that is heaven. This is an issue that's going to come back again and again in this series. That the trouble with our desires is not that they're too strong for heaven, as the Puritan thinks, but that they're too weak for heaven. Heaven is a kind of reality that's vibrant with life and joy and reality. And when we get caught up in art for art's sake, we no longer desire heaven anymore because we've lost our capacity for the wonder and joy and power of heaven. We will come back to this issue again and again in this lecture series. Let's come back to the Pilgrim's Regress. As John continues his journey, he encounters more false lures, all of which serve temporarily as idols, blocking his vision of the true object he seeks. And this goes on again and again. He confuses the means with the end. He thinks that the beauty lies in the music, or in the ideas, or in the forms, when it merely shines through those things. You see? At times, John even turns the desire itself into an idol. It becomes, again, a sort of emotional experience and nothing more. And you know what happens? He loses all desire in the fulfillment. He wants the feeling, but not the fulfillment. He chooses, Lewis says, the pain of desire over the peace of feeling it no longer. Now, as in Pilgrim's Progress, John has travelers who go with him. The most important one is a man named Virtue. And Virtue is a figure in the allegory who, like Virgil in the Divine Comedy, represents the best of classical learning and discipline. And Lewis had a great love for the, you know, classical world, the sort of Greco-Roman world. And Virtue is a good character, a good man, but despite his discipline, he lacks both joy and purpose, what the Greeks called telos, a purposeful end. He doesn't have that. And so, like Dante's virtuous pagans, Virtue becomes fixed forever in a state of desire without hope. He has discipline, but no desire to move beyond that. Now, in the allegory, Lewis has a map, and it has a north and a south. And in the north is one kind of temptation, or one kind of misdirection, if you will. In the south is another. Virtue represents the north. In the northern section of Lewis's allegory, his landscape of the soul, if you will, lies the dryness and rigidity of the cold idolatry that virtue represents. The best word for it is stoicism, that old classical thing which is discipline but lacks joy and desire. To use Nietzsche's phrase, it's Apollonian. It's too overly rational and systematic. In the south, on the other hand, we have people who have not frozen and systematized their joy, but have overindulged and perverted it. So if the north is too Apollonian, the south is too Dionysian or Dionysiac. It's too wild. These people have overindulged their passion and have lost the joy itself. Now, something interesting about this. In Surprised by Joy, which is Lewis's actual autobiography, we discover that the young Lewis also had to steer between north and south on his road to Christianity. Let me explain. For Lewis, he learned that he had to resist the lure of cold stoicism and materialism. Think of Lucretius, if you know the Roman writers. In other words, the young Lewis wanted to, like his mother, he wanted to repress his desires and repress his emotions and be a typical Englishman, if you will, and be sort of cold and rational and not allow things to get to him, if you will. That was one temptation. The other temptation that people don't often know about is that the young Lewis also had what he calls a ravenous, erotic lust for occult wisdom. And no, you know, the young Lewis worshipped William Butler Yeats, who was sort of an occult figure, the great Irish poet. And Lewis, he admits to us that his search for the occult wisdom or the occult knowledge was really at its core a kind of eroticism. Well, what the young Lewis had to learn was that neither extreme, neither stoicism nor occultism, ever satisfies. Occultism only promises forbidden knowledge. Stoicism, on the other hand, all that does is relieve us from the fear that we learn from occultism. But neither one, Lewis says, satisfies, and both are irrelevant to joy. Those are false paths. All right, let me end this lecture by discussing four more elements of desire or joy or Sehnsucht that will, by the way, come up again and again in this lecture series. First of all, and this to me is one of the most amazing things Lewis discovered, and I learned this from him. Lewis argues that it is often the good and noble things, not the low, evil, petty ones, that most often serve as idols, as roadblocks and detours on our journey to true joy. Think about it. If you are an alcoholic, if you are a drug addict, if you are caught in a cycle of fornication and broken romances, I think you're going to be pretty sure that there's more to life than that. In other words, nobody's going to take drug addiction and turn that into, or few people, maybe Leary or somebody, Timothy Leary, but few people are going to turn that into a religion. They realize that they're miserable and that they're not getting anywhere near the joy that they desired when they were young. So those things don't fool us. You know what fools us? Good things. Things like patriotism, beauty, mother love, aesthetics. all of the religion itself. Those are good things, but you know what? They're so good that they make really good counterfeits. It's very easy for a mother, let's say, to believe the maternal love she feels for her child is a sort of religion and is a satisfactory religion that can answer all the questions and give her joy. And so, again, it's the good things that often lead us astray. In a work called The Four Loves, Lewis said that love, when it becomes a god, often becomes a demon. When you try to take something from the earthly realm and make it divine or a final end, it always ends up as a demon. And that will come up again and again in this lecture series. Number two, there are two wrong ways to respond to joy or Sehnsucht. One wrong way is to move restlessly, like an ultra-romantic, from one natural object to the next in search of fulfillment. The best example is Shelley. Shelley was running from one woman to the other because he was looking for the platonic ideal of love. In our modern-day world, a man that gets married and gets divorced and marries again, and women do that too, they're seeking after joy. They keep thinking, if I just find the right mate or the right career, everything will be fine. But it's not. All you do is trade one imitation for another imitation. And the life of Shelley was very much like that. But there's another wrong way that is just as bad. Just as bad as indulging joy or seeking to fulfill it in wild ways is the opposite extreme of rejecting all desire as moonshine, being some old man from, I don't know, from Maine or something. Duh, what do I need this joy for, all those fancy romantics? Being stubborn. Lewis wants you to know that's just as bad. Again, he's not going to say that it's just the fornicators, so to speak, that are bad. The people that get stoic and resist joy and just think it's all moonshine and something for kids, they're just as bad. And they are just as likely to miss out on joy as the other extreme. Number three, when it comes to the fulfillment of our deepest God-implanted desires, so many of us are willing to settle for a pale shadow of what God offers us. I want to quote now from The Weight of Glory, which is Lewis's most famous sermon, and it's one of my favorite passages in all of Lewis. This is what he says. We, human beings, are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. We're like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. The trouble with sin is not that it's too much fun, but that it's not fun at all, if I want to put it that way. God offers us infinite love and joy and desire, and we take some mere imitation. And it's sad, Lewis says. Fourth and finally, so often, people fear to receive and accept the very thing they desire. In Surprised by Joy, his spiritual autobiography, Lewis is spending his whole life on this search. But Lewis tells us when he finally meets God face to face, you know what his response was? He was terrified. You see, Lewis was a bookish kind of guy that wanted nothing more than to be left alone. Just leave me alone. He wanted to learn intellectually, but when that real personal God came face to face, Lewis was terrified. You know what Lewis says in his autobiography? He said, I was brought into the kingdom of God kicking and screaming, the most miserable convert in all of England. Because when this happens to men that are seeking the ideal woman, and then they find her, and what happens? They're afraid of commitment. Well, that's the same thing that happens in the religious swing. We say we want God, but when he appears to us in all of his glory, we're terrified and want to be left alone. Now, I teach at a university, of course, and most university students love to see themselves as seekers. But are they real seekers or not? A real seeker wants to find. So often, modern seekers, especially in liberal modern universities, secular universities, before they begin their search, they've already decided that no matter what, they're not going to believe there's only one way to God, or believe in Christianity, or even believe in a personal God that has something he wants us to do that we have to obey. So again, if you're a true seeker, you want to seek. Not just, seekers today take seeking as an end in itself rather than as a means to an end. Let me end with an analogy from Miracles. Lewis says, our modern world are like boys playing in the attic, and they're playing at cops and robbers, and it's all exciting. If a robber comes, I'll beat him up with my stick, the little boy says. And then all of a sudden, they hear a footstep on the stairway. And suddenly, what they were playing with becomes too real, and they are